Les colloques du Collège de France.
C'est maintenant Behrouz Gamari Tabrizi que nous allons entendre. Il est chercheur invité au Center for Place, Culture and Politics à CUNY Graduate Center et professeur d'histoire et d'études iraniennes à l'Université de Toronto. Ainsi que auparavant professeur of Near Eastern Studies à Princeton University. Il est historien et sociologue. Ses recherches portent sur la révolution iranienne de 1979 et ses effets, ses afterlives, aftermaths, jusqu'au début du XXIe siècle. Il a notamment publié 3 livres sur la révolution iranienne et ses effets, Islam and Dissent in Post-Revolutionary Iran, 2008. Je dirais aussi The Long War on Iran, New Events and Old Questions, mais ce qui justifie sa présence aujourd'hui est un autre livre intitulé Foucault en Iran, Foucault in Iran, Islamic Revolution and the Enlightenment, paru en 2016, et the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. Particularly thanks to Professor Fassan for putting this amazing event together and all the people who helped him to organize this, especially Patricia, who is sitting here, and all the people behind the scenes. Almost half a century ago, writing about the Islamic Revolution, Foucault thought that Iranians might be standing at the threshold of a novelty. Today, with the American and Israeli illegal war of aggression on Iran, we can ask the same question. Does the world stand at the threshold of a novelty? Are we witnessing the beginning of the collapse of American empire, wishful thinking, and the end of the post-Cold War unipolar world order? 50 years ago, Foucault saw an insurgent temporality in the Islamic Revolution in Iran and transformative force of which continues today to reshape the existing world order. In a true Foucauldian sense, no one knows towards which direction this transformation is heading. But what is clear today is that at the end of this long war on Iran, we will face a different map of the region, the reverberations of which will be felt globally. In this presentation, I would like to discuss how Foucault turned his reports on the revolution into a commentary on the philosophy of history and suggest that his encounter with the revolutionary movement in Iran shifted the central predicament of his philosophy from the operations of power to his later works on the question of the subject, the questions of subject, truth, and the practice of parrhasia, delivered here at the Collège de France and UC Berkeley right before his passing. Foucault was deeply, as Bernard talked about it this morning, engaged with the prisons rights movement. In 1977, two French lawyers who were involved in the Iranian exilic politics brought the issues of Iranian political prisoners to his attention. He also followed the news about the Iranian Writers Association's plan to have 10 nights of poetry reading at Goethe Institute in Tehran in October of 1977. He joined a group of influential French intellectuals and signed an open letter in support of the association. His growing interest in the Iranian affairs coincided with his fascination with the idea of philosopher journalists and the challenging idea of history, of writing history of the present. After failing to find any traction with French papers, Foucault approached the Italian daily Corriere della Sera to write and edit a regular feature loosely framed as Michel Foucault Investigates. The original plan was for him to write a series on President Carter's America. However, with his newly acquired awareness of the growing political tension in Iran, in 1978, the revolutionary events in Iran overtook this project. Foucault visited Iran for the first time at the end of the summer of 1978, and for the second time just a few weeks later in the fall of the same year. Incidentally, I became aware of Foucault's writings on the Iranian Revolution by bumping into a Farsi translation of his writings of Iranian Revolution in a small book called Iran, the Spirit of the Spiritless World. this is a photo that I found in the archives of Michel Sepon, the Foucault waiting for his luggage at Mehrabad Airport in Tehran. Once he made the decision to travel to Iran, he began an intensive course of reading on Islam and Iranian history. Perhaps the most significant figure in influencing his reading list and connecting him to Iranian intellectual circles was Paul Veillet, the foremost French authority on anthropology and sociology of Iran. He was also one of the founders of Tehran University Sociology Department. Through Veillet, he met Abul Hasan Banisadr, who would become the first president of the Islamic Republic, and was encouraged to read the work of Ali Shariati, though at the time, a limited number of his writings were available in French or English. Works of Louis Massignon and his most famous disciple Henri Corbin, two towering figures of French tradition of Islamic studies, informed Foucault's comprehension of Islam. Both Massignon and later Corbin tried to circumvent doctrinal Islam and its interpretive legalism by emphasizing the significance of mysticism and Sufi traditions in Islam. The weight Massignon and Corbin attributed to mystic, spiritual, and ritualistic Islam left a considerable mark on Foucault's mind. Massignon's four-volume magnum opus, The Passion of Al-Hallaj, Mystic and Martyr of Islam, those of you who don't have to read the four-volume, there is a sort of abridged version of like 250 pages. I recommend that if you don't want to spend time for four volumes. It was exactly the type of scholarship that lent Foucault an ideal type of a truth-seeking revolutionary, thousands of concrete manifestations of which he later encountered on the streets of Tehran. Following Massignon, whose rendition of Islamic mysticism greatly influenced his own view of Islam, Ali Shariati sought to promote Hallaj as a typical representative of Islamic spirituality. Shariati took an important step further in infusing Hallaj's spirituality into his liberation theology and translating it into a language of justice and emancipation. In a lecture delivered in 1968 in Tehran, and translated to French and English in mid-1970s, Shariati marvels Hallaj's burning mind. It is known that Hallaj paced the streets of Baghdad in the 9th century, holding his head between his two hands while crying, and I quote, "Rebellion has taken me over. Release me from the fire which is burning within me." Foucault arrived in Tehran on September 10, 1978, 2 days after the capital had been stopped cold by a week of massive demonstrations. The first and second demonstrations had been peaceful and drew unprecedented numbers. According to some estimates, more than 1 million people participated in the first and hundreds of thousands more in the second. 1 million people of a city of 4 million population. Just, you know, think about that. The third demonstration, which you see the image of it here, immediately after which Foucault arrived in Tehran, known in the history of the Iranian Revolution as Black Friday, marked a turning point in the revolutionary movement. More than 85 people were massacred on Friday, September 8, 1978. This is early in the morning when they declared martial law, and people actually didn't know martial law was declared. And they gathered in a square and they see soldiers ready to shoot. And this is a photo taken right after that encounter. I wanted you to see these images to understand what Foucault is talking about when he is talking about fear, you know. The French philosopher revealed his unexpected awe in an interview that was published in March 1979. And I quote Foucault here. "When I arrived in Iran immediately after the September massacres, I said to myself that I was going to find a terrorized city because there were 4,000 dead. There were rumors of 4,000 dead, but as we all know, rumors are the most powerful instruments of revolutions. You know. Now, I can't say that I found happy people, but there was an absence of fear and an intensity of courage, or rather the intensity that people were capable of when danger, though still not removed, had already been transcended." Commenting on the unprecedented presence of the masses on the streets, Foucault described how in Tehran he witnessed a concrete manifestation of an old abstract concept in French philosophy. Incidentally, both times that Foucault visited Iran, once in September, once in November, happened right after a massacre. The second one in November happened in front of Tehran University. The photo here was a little bit wider, you could have seen me standing there, but you can't see me there, thank God. This was also in November, and only 3 days later, Foucault went to Iran, again seeing these scenes of massacre. This is a very famous photo that appeared on the front pages of a newspaper at the time, under which it had said, "Soldiers don't shoot." So a concrete example in French political philosophy, and Foucault says, and I quote, "Among the things that characterizes the revolutionary event, there is the fact that it has brought out, and a few people in history have had this, an absolutely collective will. The collective will is a political myth with which jurists and philosophers try to analyze or justify institutions. It's a theoretical tool. Nobody has ever seen collective will. And personally, I thought that the collective will was like God, like the soul, something one would never encounter. I don't know whether you agree with me, but we met in Tehran, and throughout Iran, the collective will of a people. He turned the transformative moment he experienced during the Iranian Revolution into a reflection and commentary on history. It is not far-fetched to think that he regarded himself as one of those new men that the revolution created on the streets of Tehran. He also turned the courage and the absence of fear he encountered in Tehran into an impetus and a possibility of seeing the world outside the dominant progressive narratives of the march of history. What distinguished Foucault's writing on the Iranian Revolution may be summarized in three following points. One, teleological history. Foucault defined history as a way of reinventing the present moment. This, he believed, was the distinct strength of the revolution. What attracted him to the revolution was the ambiguity with which it operated. Not ambiguity in its rejection of the Shah, but in its vision of the future, in the lack of affirmative and precise description of its agenda. In addition to the religious character of the revolution, it was this ambiguity that generated bewildering anxiety among Western intellectuals, particularly among French observers, long steeped in the national discourse of a liberating laïcité. In a gesture that characterized the most militant secularism of most French intellectuals in 1979, Claire Brière challenged the basis for Foucault's enthusiasm for the Iranian Revolution. She says, and I quote, "When a movement is called revolutionary, people in the West, including ourselves, always have the notion of progress, of something that is about to be transformed in the direction of progress. All this is put into question by the religious phenomena. Now, I don't know whether you managed, when you were in Iran, to determine, to grasp the nature of that enormous religious confrontation. Myself found it very difficult. The Iranians themselves are swimming in that ambiguity and several levels of language, commitment, and expression. It is in response to this common teleological view that Foucault emphasizes the idea that a nation's rebellion is a historical fact through which subjectivity introduces itself into history and gives it its life. Rather than making him skeptical of the nature of the revolutionary movement in Iran, Foucault viewed the fact that Iranians appear to be swimming in ambiguity as an instance of his own constitutive ambivalence toward history. In a more sociological report, originally called The Shah and the Dead Weight of Modernity, changed by the editors of Corriere della Sera to The Shah is 100 Years Behind Times, Foucault situated the revolution not in any form of failed project of modernity, but rather as evidence that it is possible to transcend modernity and the spiritless world it has instituted. He writes that he had been incessantly advised that Iran was going through a crisis of modernization, and this is a quote from Foucault, and I quote again, a traditional society cannot and does not want to follow its arrogant monarch. industrialized nations. The revolutionary events did not signify a shrinking back in the face of modernization by extremely retrograde elements to which some commentators referred to as archaic fascism. Archaic fascism was a term that Maxime Rodenson coined for identifying the Iranian Revolution. For him, archaic was modernization itself. For Foucault, archaic was modernization itself, not the religious mode of revolutionary expression. I quote Foucault here. What is old here in Iran is the Shah. He is 50 years old and 100 years behind the times. He is of the age of the predatory monarchs. He has the old-fashioned dream of opening his country through secularization and industrialization. Today, it is his project of modernization, his despotic weapons, and his system of corruption that are archaic. It is the regime that is the archaism. Foucault believed that the revolutionary movement in Iran, with its struggle to present a different way of thinking about society and politics, may offer the West the possibility of an exit from its own intellectual exhaustion. We have to abandon, he conveyed to an Iranian writer and social critic, every dogmatic principle and question one by one the validity of all the principles that have been the source of oppression. We have to construct another political thought, another political imagination, and teach anew a new vision of future. Although Foucault was right to propose that the revolutionary Iran demanded a new way of thinking about the deep connection of religion and politics, he was mistaken in thinking that the alternative based on Islamic teachings in revolutionary Iran had taken nothing from Western philosophy. He knew quite well that Ali Shariati advanced his conception of Alevite Shiism, to which Foucault refers a number of times, and his revolutionary historiography of Islam in a dialogue with and references to French existential Marxism and German phenomenological philosophy and sociology. What Foucault identifies in Iran could more accurately be defined as an idiosyncratic convergence of political and religious views that formed a revolutionary ideology without a definite association to Western conceptual commitments to history. Two, political spirituality. Although Foucault acknowledged that Shi'i Islam was the source of this political spirituality, he did not conceive of it as a dogma in a doctrinal religious frame. He saw spirituality as a desire to liberate the body from the prison house of the soul. In his typically Foucauldian inversion, he intended to highlight the ways the body seceded from the normative docility of the technologies of the self. This was not a new territory for Foucault. He grappled with the concept of spirituality years before he encountered the Iranian Revolution. He gives spirituality a corporeal meaning, an experience of the body, which he directly links to the care of the self. In his discussion of the self in his later oeuvre, Foucault remains skeptical of the liberal rational subject elicited by a governable moral order. Although in his notion of spirituality, one might detect traces of Bataille's conception of inner experience and its mystical intimations, this should not lead us to understand the act of transcendence inherent in Foucault's notion of spirituality and ethics merely as a transgressive expérience limite. Not only does such a connection discount the religious context of Foucault's discourse, more importantly, it depoliticizes his conception of spirituality and ethics. Foucault's biographer James Miller promoted this depoliticized conception and transformed it into a generally accepted frame, at least in the American context, in which Foucault's enthusiasm for the Iranian Revolution was explained away by his aesthetic fascination and obsession with death rituals of the revolutionary movement. Yet, as I see it, the ethical proposition of the care of the self and the spirituality it requires for its existence are foundationally linked to Foucault's conception of what he calls governmentalization of the state. In his scheme of power, Foucault weds the state as the instrument of coercion, religion as an institution of legitimation, and the individual as the protagonist of self-governing technologies, thereby collapsing the boundaries between politics, religion, and the ethics of self. It is in this context that one must understand his conception of the revolutionary movement in Iran. And I quote, "How can one analyze the connection between ways of distinguishing true and false and ways of governing oneself and others? The search for a new foundation for each of these practices in itself and relative to other, we will to discover a different way of governing ourselves through a different way of dividing up true and false. This is what I would call political spirituality." Contrary to a commonplace reading of Foucault's enthusiasm about the Iranian Revolution, in his view, religion does not appear as an incidental element of the movement. Rather, it links the revolutionary movement directly to people's general sense of their place in the world, in the creation of which religion plays a constitutive role. Religion afforded the revolution a vocabulary, according to Foucault, the ceremonial and the timeless drama through which a people could redefine its existence. Although the emphasis on the religious tenor of the Iranian Revolution might be superfluous, Foucault's understanding of the connection between religion and politics was uncommon. In contrast to the skepticism of his early critics and the warnings of those whom he thought were stricken by, and I quote Foucault here, excessive Westernness, he objected to the argument that the role of religion in Iran was merely to provide a doctrinal platform for revolutionary intentions. The connection he sought to explore was not between religious dogma and governance. On more than one occasion, Foucault acknowledges that, and I quote, "the mullahs are not at all revolutionary, even in its populist sense of the term." And end of quote. References to religion in his writings on the Iranian Revolution was not to anything spoken by the mullahs or articulated by any other exponent of the divine text. According to Foucault, writing on October 8, 1978, religion constituted a force that perpetuated the hermeneutics of the subject on the streets of revolutionary Iran. Of course, in all these, you see the traces of his later lectures in College of France and Berkeley. Foucault thought Shiism was particularly conducive to the kind of hermeneutics that he deemed essential in the total transformation of the self. As I stressed earlier, his knowledge of Shi'i Islam, at least in its classical context, was shaped by the French scholarship advanced by Massignon and Corbin, both of whom regarded the quest for justice and mystical spirituality as the kernel of Shi'ism. He was also intrigued by Shariati's hermeneutical approach and his emphasis on the transformation of the self as the precondition of revolutionary act. In the following conversation with Claire Berrier and Pierre Blanchet in March 1979 in Paris, Foucault shifted the debate on the basis for revolutionary movement from both Marxist economic determinism as well as the Orientalist textual reading of Islam. And this is a bit of a long quote. With whatever the economic difficulties, Foucault says, we still have to explain why there were people who rose up and said, we are not having any more of this. In rising up, the Iranians said to themselves, and perhaps in the soul of the uprising, of course we have to change this regime and get rid of this man. We have to change this corrupt administration. We have to change the whole country, the political organization, the economic system, the foreign policy. But above all, we must change ourselves, our way of being, our relationship with others, with things, with eternity, with God, must be completely changed. And there will only be a true revolution if this radical change in our existence takes place. I believe that it is here that Islam plays a role. It may be that one or other of these obligations, one or other of these codes exerted in a certain fascination, but above all, in relation to the way of life, and was theirs, religion for them was like a promise and guarantee of finding something that would radically change their subjectivity. In Iran, Foucault recognized the possibility in Islam of a continuous and active creation of a political order perpetuated by an individual experience of piety and the care of the self. In contrast to a common Orientalist theme, which is strictly committed to hermeneutics of the text and law, Foucault highlights the experience of and desire for justice in the hermeneutics of the subject. Like Shariati, he conceives Islam as a religion that has given people inexhaustible resources for resisting the power of the state. In the Iranian Revolution, Foucault observed a displacement and a rescue at the same time of the tradition of modernity. He predicted that his enthusiasm would scandalize the French, whose commitment to laïcité was fundamental to their intellectual expression. Even his friends ridiculed him. One of them, Claude Mauriac, who had been influenced by Foucault and Gilles Deleuze in the early 1970s to retreat from his earlier Gaullist politics, recalled a private conversation on November 23, 1978, in which he expressed reservations to Foucault about his support of a political spirituality. Mauriac recounted his conversation in his memoirs. He says, I read your paper in Nouvel Observateur, but not without surprise, I must say, Foucault. And you laughed. You are among those that I could already see are laughing. Mauriac, no, I only said to myself that as to spirituality and politics, we have seen what that has given us, Foucault, and politics without spirituality, my dear Claude? Third, is it useless to revolt? Foucault's enthusiasm about revolutionary politics in Iran was also informed by a fervent debate in French intellectual circles kindled by François Fouret's revisionist account of the French Revolution's place in history. Fouret introduced a general skepticism about the significance and wisdom of revolutions in world history, consigning the French experience from a constitutive event of modern European history to an anomaly with everlasting tension between 1789 and 1793. In a post-1968 France, Fauré's revisionist intervention struck a chord with the defeatist French left and triumphant liberals, those who wanted, in Zizek's word, a decaffeinated revolution or a revolution which does not smell of a revolution. Not only Foucault tried to make sense of revolutionary spirituality, but also he admired the fact that the Iranian masses revived the spirit of revolution, which many Europeans believed had disappeared from history. By locating the spirit of the revolution in Iran, Foucault inverted another central element of Orientalism, that is that of unchanging essence of Muslim societies. Instead, he laments the stagnation of Western subjectivity and the dominant skepticism about revolutionary political spirituality. How far do we want to generalize from Foucault's journalism? Did witnessing revolution in Iran alter his general understanding of the mass, of the means and possibilities of resistance to power? Did he deviate in his observations of events in Iran from his understanding of resistance to power as an act that extends our participation in the present system? Many early critics of Foucault, particularly in feminist scholarship, had rebuked his conception of power for his lack of recognition of the real possibility of resistance. Foucault, Nancy Fraser once pointed out, adopts a concept of power that permits him no condemnation of any objectionable feature of modern societies. While it is debatable whether Foucault followed Derrida in negating the possibility of actual resistance to present arrangements, nevertheless, his all-encompassing and generative notion of power troubled both the partisans as well as detractors of his theory. One of the most vociferous of his critics, Jürgen Habermas, also castigated Foucault for what appeared to be a nihilistic apathy towards emancipatory politics. Richard Rorty added his voice to the chorus in viewing Foucault as a, and I quote, stoic, a dispassionate observer of the present social order rather than its concerned critic. Foucault did attempt to avoid the categorical condemnation of all forms of resistance, which his critics read into his work. He went to considerable lengths to explain the nuances of his conception of power and governmentality. Although he developed a more cohesive theory of counterpower and resistance in his later works on ethics and care of the self, in his earlier writings, contrary to his detractors' claims, he did not trivialize resistance as simply another means of participating in disciplinary power. But it is in his post-1979 writings that he carefully considers the significance of revolt as an ethical concern, in spite of the fact that it would result in giving rise to other institutions of disciplinary power. In On the Genealogy of Ethics, Foucault responded to the charge that one can spot what appears to be a quietism in his work. In a reply to the question whether the Greek philosophy was an attractive and plausible alternative to contemporary ethics, Foucault cried out, no, I'm not looking for an alternative. You can't find a solution to of a problem in the solution of another problem raised at another moment by other people. You see, what I want to do is not the history of solutions, and that's the reason why I don't accept the word alternative. My point is not that everything is bad, but everything is dangerous, which is not exactly the same as bad. If everything is dangerous, then we always have something to do. So my position leads not to apathy, but to hyper and pessimistic activism. And I finish here, sorry if I went too long. The paradoxical notion of pessimistic activism captures the core of Foucault's response to the Iranian revolution. In his very last piece on the subject, Is It Useless to Revolt?, published in May 1979, on the first page of Le Monde, Foucault responded to the growing crowd of critics who ridiculed him for cheering on a revolution whose objective was the establishment of an Islamic state. In perhaps the most moving passage of his entire revolutionary reportage, he defended his enthusiasm without endorsing its outcome. He wrote, and I finish with this long passage, "Uprisings belong to history, but in a certain way, they escape it. The movement through which a lone man, a group, a minority, or an entire people say, 'I will no longer obey,' and are willing to risk their lives in the face of a power that they believe to be unjust seems to me to be irreducible. This is because no power is capable of making it absolutely impossible. Warsaw will always have its ghetto in revolt and its sewers populated with insurgents. The man is in revolt is ultimately inexplicable. There must be an uprooting that interrupts the unfolding of history. It is long series of reasons why, for a man really to prefer the risk of death over the certainty of having to obey, if societies persist and survive, that is to say, if power in these societies is not absolutely absolute, it is because behind all the consent and coercion, beyond the threats, the violence, and the persuasion, there is the possibility of this moment where life cannot be exchanged, where their power becomes powerless, and where in front of the gallows and the machine guns, men rise up." Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.